The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome back to the Sunday Space Show, live as I am out of North Dakota in the frozen tundra for a while. And it is great to be back live with the toll-free line and all of the bells, frills, and whistles that the Space Show can offer. And we're going to have an excellent, excellent, fun program. I've had a really great email exchanges with our guest today. Been talking to him on the phone for the past 15 minutes. Of course, I've read his book. We'll talk about that in just a minute. For those of you who are going to want to call us today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Now, remember, this is an MCI toll-free number. So if you're outside the United States and your country allows toll-free calls to the United States, contact your in-country MCI operator and give that person this number. Tell them it's going to the San Francisco Bay Area, and they should be able to connect you through our toll-free line. If your country doesn't accept or work with toll-free calls to the United States, you might want to get another country or petition whoever is in charge of these things, because you should be able to call toll-free to the U.S. if you have a toll-free number. Okay, and then email, if you want to use that to talk to us, is drspace@thespaceshow.com. thespaceshow@gmail.com and dmlivings@yahoo.com. As I told you before I went to North Dakota, we would be moving our Dr. Space email servers. That move has happened, and we don't have any problems, and we're up and running. But the website, thespaceshow.com, is still due to be moved, I believe, later this week. And you may see it offline for a couple of days. We know about it, we are aware of it, and it has to do with moving to a new server because of the problems when XO Communication decided to delist my internet provider's account toward the end of last year. They're through dealing with XO, so they are moving to a new company. So anyway, if you do see our website go down, we're aware of it. It's because we're moving it, and just sit tight. You may need to reboot your computer to recognize the new DNS. But you'll get through that, as will I. Remember that the Space Show is trademarked and registered, but you are free to download shows and copy them and share them and pass them around. But don't do anything commercial, and please don't edit any of the programs. We thank Andrew at gigadial.net. He does handle all of our podcasting for us. The RSS URL is on our website, both of our newsletters, and our podcast is in iTunes, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and we are now on Zune, which is second only to iTunes. That's the Microsoft podcasting service. If you go to the website newsletter that I will upload after this program, just before we get into telling you what's on for the four programs this coming week, I have the Zune dedicated URL for their podcasting. So if you want to use Zune, Z-U-N-E, through Microsoft, you'll see that dedicated URL. If you want to email me for it, please do so. Be happy to send it to you. Do also remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then also do remember that we do the blog for Space Show programs. You're welcome to comment. Make your comments relevant to the program, otherwise it does not get posted. The URL for the Space Show blog, http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. So let me tell you about our guest today and what we're going to be doing. Our guest is Dwight, and I'm going to call him Dwight because I'm probably going to blow his last name, but it's Dwight Stephen, tell me if I do it wrong, Bonietsky. Did I get it right?
Correct.
Ah, okay, from now on you're just Dwight. I'm not going to risk a second one. But Dwight is an Australian living in Germany. He has written one of the best historical and factual and interesting books I've had an opportunity to read in a long time, published by Apogee, called Live TV from the Moon. So, you know, we've all read, you know, tons of books about going to the moon and this and that and the other. Did you know how the TV shots were done from the moon? For example, when Neil climbed down, you know, the ladder to make his famous statement, who was already on the moon taking pictures? Was it, you know, an ET from the glass ruins on the surface of the moon, or did they figure it out some other way? Well, that is what our guest has factually documented and written about. Dwight was born in Sydney, Australia. He was born just a few months before people went to the moon, so he is of the Apollo generation. He spent much of his childhood fascinated with space exploration. He grew up in the shadow of Apollo and under the direct influence of science fiction films such as Star Wars, the latter shaping his desire to work in the film and television industry. He studied television theory at North Sydney Technical College. Then he moved to San Diego and he interned at Daniels Cablevision, returning to Australia and working for TCN9 before heading back to the university where he majored in psychology. Following his studies, he decided that television was where he truly wanted to be. He returned to the industry working for Foxtel in Australia. From there, he heard about the expansion on satellite TV in Eastern Europe. He got on an airplane, and he worked in Europe, first in Great Britain for WIZJA-TV, and then in Germany for CBC/RTL, where he still works as a transmission controller. Anyway, His full bio is already up on the website because of the newsletter. It will be up again when we archive this show. But we're going to talk about this Apogee book, Live TV from the Moon. Now, it is already available and listed on the One Giant Leap Foundation Amazon Partners page. So if you buy it from Amazon through One Giant Leap, Amazon makes a nice contribution to the space show. Welcome to the space show, Dwight, and it's good to talk to you, and what a great book you wrote. You want to sort of give us the genesis of how you even got the idea to do this book?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's, a wonder of technology that we can do an interview via telephone over the continent.
Yeah, it's even a better wonder of technology that some government hasn't pulled the plug on the internet in our countries like they're doing in Egypt right now. So,
I know. It's scary what's going on.
It is. So, people, if you don't think it can happen where any of us live, you know, always be vigilant. That's all I can say. Always be vigilant. But we're great and good to go, and I want to know how somebody was already on the moon taking Neil's picture as he came down those steps.
I wanted to know that as well, and I was interested in space since a kid, like it says in the book. My father was absolutely in awe of the Apollo missions, and he recorded all the radio transmissions on his reel-to-reel machine, and I heard them as a child and had vague memories when he was watching the Apollo 17 mission of seeing the guys on television. He then grabbed me. He was just so enthralled by it. He took me outside and on our balcony we could see the moon. And he said to me, can you see the men on there? Can you see the men? And I was like, no, but I want to. And that's where the interest came from. And then like they pulled the plug on Apollo. Had Skylab. I have a couple of memories of Skylab, and then the next thing, I was just in that age where I remember the men on the moon, and there was nothing in between apart from Apollo Soyuz and then the shuttle approach and landing tests, and that was it. There was like this for a couple of years. There was just a vacuum of information, and then by the time the shuttle flew, then Apollo was long forgotten, and it was like this mission for me. I wanted to see the missions complete, and it happened in 1989 when I was in San Diego that I managed to watch the entire Apollo 11 retelecast on Arts and Entertainment Network with a program called As It Happened. And that's where I sat there and I thought, wow, how did they do this? And I was just starting in television at the time, and it was one of these things, yes, I'd love to find out more about the missions and put it on the back burner. And then it happened in just after I moved here to Germany, where I heard about a company in the United States called Spacecraft Films that put out DVDs of the complete missions, and all of them, not just Apollo 11. And I was like, oh, these are the things I've been waiting my whole lifetime to see. So I ordered them, and then, again, watching them with the eye of a television technician, I was thinking to myself, why do the colors look funny every time something moves quickly across the screen? Or the same question like you asked me, how was the camera positioned to get his first step, to get Neil Armstrong's first step on the moon? And I started to look on the internet for information, and to my dismay, even though the information was there, it wasn't in a cohesive form. And I had to look around, I had to ask people, and it just happened that I had maybe a folder full of notes just for my own personal interest, and got to speaking to some other space historians at one of the autograph shows they hold in England, and he said to me, oh, you should do a magazine article. And I was thinking to myself, magazine article is great, but I've got too much information. It actually is the size for a book. And then somebody else, and I, to this day I don't remember who it was, said to me, we should do a book. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a great idea, not realizing that 6 years of my life would be devoted to doing that book. And that's how it got started.
When you were growing up in Australia with all of this, were you aware of the Australian role in the relays and the radio telescopes in making the TV signal available globally? Because I've done shows with the people from the radio telescope who actually ran that program. But were you aware of Australia's role in the moon landings?
Not as a child, no.
So it wasn't that well publicized or put out there that Australia was playing a key role with NASA?
It was, because my parents kept the newspaper clippings. They mentioned it like the headline news in Australia, that we were a part of it, and for the fact as well that Honeysuckle and Parkes got the first
signals.
In hindsight, I can see it was well publicized. I don't recall it as a child. I don't recall as a kid knowing that Australia had such an important part to play.
Okay, I just was curious. We didn't know it at all until the movie The Dish came out, 10 years ago or whenever it came out, and all of a sudden, you know, our horizons were expanded as to the role of Australia with NASA in allowing us all to see the TV from the moon, which is what your book is about. So how did they position the camera? Who was on the moon first? Was it a Russian? And it's just a deep, dark, black secret?
Yes.
So you're...
I found a document that said it was a Russian.
Oh, my God.
Stoyanov, actually.
Let's see what your life expectancy will be after this show.
Oh.
For divulging state secrets.
As long as it was before. I'm
sure. All right.
No.
How did it happen, or is the landing on the moon a total hoax?
No. I didn't find anything in my research to suggest that the whole thing was fake in any studios. One of the questions that a lot of the people that don't believe it happened do ask is, who filmed Neil Armstrong coming down there? And it was a question that I suspected they had the camera mounted on the outside, but I wasn't entirely sure. And what they did is they had it mounted in the modular equipment storage assembly, which was folded up when the lunar module landed. And when Neil Armstrong was on the porch of the LEM, he pulled a lanyard that triggered the thing to open. The camera was then positioned upside down, but at an angle that would have the ladder in shot, and would photograph Neil Armstrong as he stepped onto the lunar surface. The trouble being, the camera was upside down, so they had to have electronics on the ground that would invert the image to make it right side up when we saw it on the TV screen.
So
that's how they did it. And that was all planned long beforehand. They had studies conducted which was the best angle to mount the thing, what electronics would be necessary for the image to be right side up. And once they had that all sorted out, it was just a matter of Neil pulling the lanyard to deploy the thing.
It's amazing that everything worked. And I still find it even today that everything worked. In your research and with the people you talked to who made this equipment and all of that, were they extremely confident that everything was going to work when it needed to work?
I spent a lot of time talking with a wonderful gentleman who unfortunately did not live to see the book come out. He knew I had finished it. That was Stan LaBar from Westinghouse. He was confident that they had done all the testing they could do to ensure the thing would work when they turned it on the lunar surface. But like everybody else, he was grabbing onto the seat in front of him in mission control as they were ready to turn the camera on, because until it was turned on, there were no guarantees. There were an enormous amount of tests done on the camera for dust, or vibration testing. The lens seals, everything had to be tested to the point that the thing really had a 99.9999997% success rate. And then that's why they were confident it would work on the moon.
Interesting, very, very interesting. So to find out all of this information into your research, what was your methodology? How did you start out, and were the companies willing to go back through their records to help you? Did you meet a lot of resistance? Was NASA helpful? Tell us a little bit about the process.
Absolute unhindered help from the second I announced that's what I was going to do. For example, with Stan, I would ask him one question. For example, tell me about the handle you devised that the astronauts could hold the camera in their hand if they had to. And I would expect we developed it in 1965. It was manufactured by so-and-so, and that's it. But he would then say, okay, look, I wasn't directly responsible for this. Contact this fellow. This is the document I had. I would get an email that was 3 pages long. I would get attachments in the way of scans of original memos, all in the one, just from the one question. Then that was talking directly with people like Stan or Sam Russell from RCA. They would go out of their way to help me. They would send me stuff without even me asking. And that was just from their personal collections that they kept from the time they were working there. Then I got a lot of material, the preliminary material from the NTRS, which is the NASA Technical Report Server. And a lot of that material is in PDF format, and it's online and freely downloadable. So I would get, and that is a lot of the stuff that is explanatory how the thing worked in a very cursory, basic level. So I could get an understanding of that, and then I could go and look further for more of the internal memos about how they progressed with each model of camera. And that material I got from the JSC History Archives. And the personnel there were absolutely fantastic. They went out of their way to get every single document I needed on time, scanning the material. Originally, I was getting it photocopied. Then I found out I could get the material scanned and be already in PDF, because I would get them the hard copy, have to scan it myself, and that took hours. They would then scan the material for me, and as I found out just at the beginning of this year, because I'm doing a bit of additional research to the post-Apollo television stuff, that they're moving all the archives for Apollo and Skylab from JSC to the National Archives, and they actually emailed me to show you how helpful they were. Before I had asked them for anything, they said, look, we are moving our documents. Is there anything you need from us? And the woman who was helping me, what's her name, Jean Grant, was absolutely fantastic. She said, look, this stuff is going by the end of the week. If you want it, I'll start scanning it now for you, and I'll get it off to you as soon as possible. And so that's how much help I got in doing this project. Nobody at any point said, no, I can't help you.
And never was anything told you, this is off limits, this is black, you can't see this, or anything like that. You were never left being suspicious about anything, is that correct?
Absolutely. The only thing that disappointed me, and this is just the passage of time, that certain documents, there would be a reference to look up in this magazine, and it actually wasn't NASA-related material. There was a lot of documentation in the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, and that material is hard to come by without actually going to New York, and I I accessed their material from a television library in Australia, and that is probably the only thing that it was an annoying fact of life, basically, that those documents weren't available. But there was nothing I found that would suggest to me in any way that there was something suspicious going on.
So, you know, I grew up as a teenager with Apollo, and of course we were all, you know, glued to the TV stations in Tulsa and every place else. And of course there were only three TV stations anyway, and they were all carrying the same thing. So if you wanted to watch TV, you were watching Apollo no matter what. And there were no VCRs or home movies or anything like that back then. But we kind of took for granted that everything the United States was going to do for space was going to be made available publicly and live on television, yet the Soviet Union space program was not, and that was a very, very sharp contrast to we were even willing to show Vanguard blow up on the launch pad and other problems, whereas, you know, you didn't see live anything with the Soviet Union. In your research, did you ever find a serious debate on whether or not they should do live television from the moon and document this with live television? Was there a school of thought that said don't show this on television?
There was. There were two sides at NASA. There were the public affairs officials who were saying the taxpayer has paid for this. They have a right to have television. It is in our interest to show it. Then there was the other side, which were essentially the managers and engineers, that were saying, look, this is not mission critical. Whether they land on the moon has nothing to do with whether they've got a camera on board or not. It's another nuisance that we can do without. We don't need to have it. Now, from a purely logical point of view, it makes sense. But from a historical or from a an emotional point of view, it is extremely short-sighted. And there were certain individuals within the public affairs office who let the networks know that this is what people were talking about, and the networks put pressure on Washington, who therefore put pressure on the head honchos at NASA. And it's an interesting sort of, it was never a clearly defined battle, but it seemed to sort of go this way, that way, like a pendulum, basically. But at the whole time, they had developed cameras from day one of announcing of the Apollo missions through to the last mission. There was always a camera in the works. It was just how serious, as a tool for the exploration, how serious that was taken on board. And that's where the fighting started, because the astronauts, for example, Wally Schirra or Frank Borman, saw absolutely no point to having the camera on board, and were actually very vocal about the fact they didn't want to take the camera with them. Then there was the public affairs that were saying, you have to take it. Trust us, it's a good idea. The thing is, when they figured out, especially in the case of Apollo 7, where Wally Schirra refused on air to ground communications with Houston, refused to turn the camera on when he was asked to do so according to the timeline, and he said, no, I'm not turning it on until we're good and ready to turn it on. His argument being that his close friends were the crew of Apollo 1, an electrical arc had caused the fire on Apollo 1, and he wasn't about to unnecessarily turn on any equipment that could possibly redo that until he was sure it was safe to do so. And that was his argument. I don't know how much of it was in hindsight after they realized how popular the TV shows were, that they didn't want to admit that at the beginning they didn't quite understand how powerful a medium it would be. Similar with Frank Borman, he did not want to take the camera with him. And the quote at the start of the chapter is, I didn't want to take the damn camera with me. What they didn't realize when they turned the camera back onto the Earth, that changed the way humanity saw itself. And that nobody, I think, even public affairs, had no idea that that would happen.
Yeah, and I remember that. And I mean, that was a big, big shock. I mean, again, for younger people, and seeing those pictures and seeing Earthrise and all of that, you kind of take it for granted. But, man, when that happened live, you know, for real, there was nothing about taking that for granted. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. And little side note to that, because they didn't have a viewfinder on the camera, they were pointing blind, being guided by Houston. They had to actually use the RCS thrusters on the command module on Apollo 8 to turn the spaceship around so it could frame the shot of the Earth properly.
What did you find to be the most intriguing of your research? What grabbed you the most when you were going through the data and putting your book together?
How they put the color signal together. That was the thing I thought, oh, it's ingenious and yet so simple.
So what did they do?
Well, they had they went back to technology developed very early on in television's history, which there was talk of experiments with John Logie Baird with his mechanical television system, and he developed color by using a three-filtered wheel that would spin in front of the mechanism to produce color. And it's a system called sequential color, and that means that the colors come in sequence. So red comes first, then comes blue, then comes green, or whichever order they're in. And they are projected fast enough that your eye and the brain combine the colors into a full color spectrum.
But how does it know that you're wearing a green shirt?
Right, because each color has a different luminosity and a different color spectrum. And white light is made from red, blue, and green colors. So when you combine the three colors, if you're shooting a white light, if you use a red filter, that color will look red. If you use the blue one, it'll look blue. And if you use the green, it'll look green. But the percentage in the colors, when they are combined together as a projected light, they become white. And then any other color is a derivative of those, if that makes any sense.
So did they do that with the cameras on the moon, or was that processed back on Earth before it went out to TV?
They had the color wheel in the cameras, which spun around, and they were electronically controlled so that the thing would remain in synchronization with the TV signal. So you wouldn't get a crossing like black bar. It would always be when the scanning ray was scanning the image through the lens. Then that was sent as the sequential color of red, green, and blue back to Earth. It was then stored on a, at that time, brand new disc recording system that would store the red channel first, then the blue channel, and then the green channel. And because they were coming one after the other, they had to find a way to delay the first one so it would match with the second color and the third color, and then that one would come in live, and then the other two would be delayed. And what they ended up doing is creating a full color image from these three separate colors using a delay system, like a frame buffer. And then that is also why when you see fast movement on the screen when you're watching the Apollo missions, it's because the motion is happening so quickly that this delay system hasn't had time to catch up with the actual movement on the screen between the frames. And that's why you see this confetti color-looking artifact in the screen or in the image.
Fascinating that they were able to think all this through and figure it out, and that it really did work.
Well, that's the thing that actually got me like committed to doing the book, because I could not for the life of me work it out. I hope I've explained it clear enough. Because it took me ages to understand how they did it, because I could not work it out. And then, again, one of the engineers sent me a document and said, that's how we did it. I was like, aha, I get it now. I'm trying to think of something that's similar to doing it, that somebody could practically try it themselves.
Who made the cameras, the movie cameras?
The cameras were made by two companies. The first batch of cameras for the Block 1, which was the Apollo 1-style command module, which was, in layman's terms, a prototype, were made by RCA. They were given the subcontract from North American, who designed and built the command module, and they were hoping to get the contract as well to build the lunar camera. And early documentation shows that RCA were hopeful that that's what would happen. In the meantime, another company, Westinghouse, had done a lot of work for the Department of Defense in infrared cameras and surveillance cameras being used in the Vietnam War. And they had a very good reputation within the government circles. So NASA actually approached Westinghouse to see what type of camera technology they had as far as low-light cameras went, because they were concerned about there not being sufficient light on the lunar surface if they intended to land at night, at lunar night. And so then Westinghouse was asked to build a prototype that could function on the lunar surface, and that's how Westinghouse got the contract to build the camera used on Apollo 11. Then, through an interesting chain of events, Westinghouse wanted to go to color as soon as possible and had to find this simple way to do it because of the bandwidth limitations. And astronaut Tom Stafford was so impressed with the colors he saw when he looked back at the Earth during his missions in Gemini that he wanted color television as soon as possible on his mission, which was Apollo 10. And the two companies, Westinghouse and Tom Stafford, were pushing to get color television at the same time, and suddenly one found about the other, and they did a demonstration for Tom Stafford at Westinghouse, and he was so impressed with the color image, which was basically an ever-ready battery, because that's the only thing of any color that they had in the testing laboratories for the black and white camera, that he went back to NASA and said, "I want this camera on my flight." And that's how color television made it on Apollo 10. Now, in the meantime, while Westinghouse was getting geared up for all the subsequent landings of 12, 13, 14, RCA had approached NASA again and said, "We've got a remote-controlled color system. If you're intending to use a lunar rover on the moon, we've got a camera that can be remotely driven so that the astronauts can do what they want to. This thing stays on the rover, and we can control it from Houston." And that's how they got the contract to do the lunar rover television camera.
Nothing like a little bit of competition, right?
Well, it even went beyond Apollo. There was then the competition for Skylab, and then the competition again for Apollo Soyuz test project, and then the competition for the space shuttle. So it kept on going right up until the 80s.
Amazing. Dwight, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, we'll start taking in some listener questions. And by the way, listeners, again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. You can call in during the break, and we'll hold you over if you would like. Otherwise, back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Sunday Space Show. We're talking about the book Live TV from the Moon. It's author Dwight Steven, let's hope I can do it, Bonietsky. Did I get it right?
Nearly. Bonietsky.
Bonietsky. So the cover of the book has this really cool old-fashioned black-and-white TV on it. What is that, and where'd you find that thing?
That is at the, let me just open the book because I will quote the place where it comes from. That comes from the Early Television Museum in Hilliard, Ohio. And they have all these old television sets from the world over, but predominantly from the United States. And that is an old Baird TV, as far as I remember, or Bush TV. Hold on. Let me just... Let's see if I can, I've got the facts straight, but I contacted the museum, and I had no idea about it when we found the photo, that Stan LaBar from Westinghouse was a patron of the place and loved going there. And when the fellow heard that I was doing the book and talking about Stan's life, he said, you can use any photo you like. And I was saying, Bush TV 12, it's, I think it was from 1930-something possibly, or 1950, thereabouts. It's an ancient television.
Well, the funny thing is, I actually remember seeing TVs like that in people's houses back when I was a kid. I mean, that was kind of the standard black and white, sort of a table model type of TV.
Yeah.
Everything was kind of table model, you know, versus
Australia
console.
Didn't get color television until 1974, so that was still pretty stock standard back in Australia.
Listeners, our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call us, and hopefully you'll call instead of using email, 1-866-687-7223. Todd in San Diego, your old stomping grounds, said, how much training did it take for the astronauts to work the cameras and the TV systems that they had to do, and how much did it detract from their astronaut training?
The closest I can give an answer to that is from Apollo-Soyuz test project. Deke Slayton had 5 hours worth of training on the camera, and that was, at that time, more advanced than anything they had on Apollo. That was, again, a Westinghouse camera, but with a lot more features on it. I would imagine in the Apollo days they had the same amount of training. Having said that, for Apollo 12, there's the situation where Alan Bean didn't pay attention to his checklist, which said omit upsun when he removed the camera from the lunar module to place it on the tripod to shoot the lunar module as they did on Apollo 11. In the process, he didn't pay attention where he was pointing the camera to and pointed it directly at the sun. And now, because the pickup tube inside the camera was a low-light sensitive camera, the sun at that brightness on the moon with no atmospheric effects to block any of that light burnt that image sensor away, rendering the camera essentially useless. So no matter how much training an astronaut had, you know, they were prone to making mistakes. As far as detracting from the amount of training they did, it was incorporated at a very early point on into the flight or the flight plan. For example, if you look at the training film that was shot in Houston for Apollo 11, it's just part of the procedures that they used when they were conducting their simulated moonwalk. So as far as the astronauts were concerned, it didn't take anything out of their schedule. The one thing with Apollo 7 and Apollo 8, they were concerned it was taking time out of their responsibilities inside the command module. So for them, they were still of the old mind that why are we taking this thing along? What's the point of having it along? It wasn't so much that they were worried about how much time it took them. It's why do we have this thing here in the first place? It serves no purpose to us conducting a 100% successful mission.
Listeners, on page 101 of the on the book, there's a picture of two of the field sequential color converters built for NASA. And I have to tell you, they're huge. And when I say huge, you know, they're, you know, the size of a wall. And I'm telling you, if someone from this generation just stepped into this world, and was handed an iPhone or a Droid or something like that, they'd probably think it was magic, because those things, for example, I'm looking at the iPhone for Verizon, so it's either 16 gigabytes of storage or 32 gigabytes of storage, and you told me this thing could only hold 30 seconds of video.
That's correct. That's correct. It was based on the slow motion system that was developed by Ampex, which was commercially released in 1967 and first used on American football to slow-mo touchdowns and tackles or whatever was of interest to watch in slow motion. And some smart cookie, and this is the absolute genius of the whole thing, thought, hang on a second, we can use this thing to store video as well. In the case of the sequential colors, that we store the red in there for the three fields or the three frames that we need to store it for, and they modified it so that the tracks would then be allocated like a frame buffer to then be mixed together to form the full color image. And that's why they were so bulky, because that's the only way they could do it in those days.
And this was what year, 19 what?
The first color pictures were in May 1969.
And the Ampex slow-mo was when?
1967. Towards the end of 1967. I can't remember. I think it was November. I'm not quite sure. But that it was very, very new technology, not even 18 months old by the time it was modified to handle something of that magnitude.
Another question, Bob in Denver, is there any estimate of how much it added to the cost of our space program to do live television from the moon?
The cameras themselves, I have a document somewhere. It was definitely in the millions. That's complete design and research for the cameras. There was the additional cost of modifying the tracking stations to be able to handle full frame color video, but a lot of it was modification. It wasn't outright cost for a new equipment. They could actually modify the equipment they had to receive it and to process it, with the exception of the color converter, of course. The cameras themselves, they were in the millions. Unfortunately, I don't have the specs in front of me of how much it did cost. But
where did the cameras end up?
In the ones on the lunar surface are still there.
Right, but I mean the ones that I'm assuming they didn't trash this equipment, so it's in a museum someplace.
Oh, there are several models, and again, I don't know which ones. The Apollo 7 camera is in the Smithsonian. The Apollo 8, I have no idea, to be perfectly honest. They are definitely in museums. Most of them are in the United States that I know of, with the exception of one Apollo Soyuz test project camera, which happened to find its way down to Tipinbilla tracking station back in the day for some publicity tour or nobody knows what. They found it and didn't know if it was an original camera or a training camera or a mock-up or what. So they contacted Stan Labar, who had all the serial numbers of these cameras, and he said, this one went up on the mission, definitely went up on the mission. And so that's now in the Tidbinbilla Tracking Station Visitors Museum.
And that's in Australia?
That's in Australia, and nobody knows how it got there.
Does anyone know where it is, where the museum is?
Yep, that is at the actual tracking station in Tidbinbilla, which is around about 30 kilometres. Sorry, I'm speaking metric for people that don't know metric. Around about 20 miles outside of Canberra, which is now the only tracking station left. Honeysuckle was closed down in the 1980s, and most of the gear was shipped over to Tidbinbilla. Unfortunately, the Honeysuckle Creek antenna, which received the first lunar pictures, was decommissioned year before last, as far as I remember. And at that tracking station, they have a visitor's centre, and you can go in there, and they have nice little displays of all the Apollo missions, all the stuff that Honeysuckle and Tidbinbilla tracked. And since they found that camera, which would have been in 2008, thereabouts, it's now on display there. So you can go in there, cost you nothing to go in, and they've got that camera on display.
Another one. This is Joe, and Joe says he's in Shreveport, Louisiana. And he said, we always hear about NASA technology filtering in and impacting in a positive way the commercial market. So my question is, how long did it take for this color camera technology to come into the commercial markets, and did any of this influence or speed up the development of video cameras, technology that we're using now, things like that, in at least in the early stages? Did the taxpayer see a commercial benefit and transition from what they did with going to the moon on the photographic equipment?
Absolutely. The first avenue they would have seen that in would have been the electronic news gathering. The color technology was specific to Apollo. They never really caught on commercially because it was an incompatible system with NTSC, and the news companies didn't want to have this artifacting for news stories. It's just it was acceptable for lunar exploration, but it's not acceptable for news events that are happening just down the street or across the road, whatever. But the miniaturization, which was one of the key factors in the camera technology on Apollo, that directly impacted every aspect of video cameras, be it studio cameras or domestic cameras. The fact that you had Portapak cameras in the early 70s are a direct result of the miniaturization that was carried out by Westinghouse and RCA. So it was a bit of a slower and not so evident benefit, but it did impact very much so. It revolutionized news gathering, that is without a doubt.
Well, this was film and not video, right?
No, this was video.
So the cameras were all, everything was video?
Everything was videotaped. The cameras were video cameras. They had incompatible frame rates and so forth, and because of the color system, they had to convert it first before it was viewable on television. But everything was live and it was not film. The Apollo 11 camera was a different type of scanning rate. It had 10 frames per second as opposed to the normal 30 frames per second. And it was 320 lines of resolution, whereas normal NTSC is 525. Now, they needed a special converter in order to do that, to bring it to the conventional American format so that people could watch it at home. And that was developed by RCA and worked by having a high-resolution TV monitor that received that 10-frame, 320-line image on a very high-persistence monitor. A camera then would photograph that one frame as it came in, would then send that to a disc recording system, similar to the way they did the color, and that disc recorder would then replay that frame another three times in order to get the frame rate up to 30 frames a second. So it was one frame live, two frames delayed, for the course of the 30 frames per second then to get a conventional NTSC system TV image.
Here's another question for you. Andrea in Dallas, Texas. And Andrea says, I was growing up and watching this at the time, and I remember the Hasselblad company marketed like mad that their cameras went to the moon. So I'm assuming that this was for the still photography. And a lot of people were buying Hasselblads because it had the reputation of having been used on the moon. Did your research go into the still photography and the Hasselblads? How were they modified, or were they modified, or was it just a shelf camera that was able to do the still photography?
I didn't do that much research on the Hasselblads. It was a decision I made early on just because I had so much information about the television stuff. What I know about the Hasselblads is just from reading the books and so forth myself. They were produced by Hasselblad but modified with thermal protection so that they could withstand the heat variations on the lunar surface.
And I know the film was totally modified for being on the moon.
Yeah.
It wasn't stock film. Kodak did the film, and it was not what you'd go down and buy at the time in your camera store. But they sure marketed the heck out of that and got a lot of advertising mileage. I remember the Hasselblad ads for years and years and years for their cameras having been on the surface of the moon.
Well, they did that as well with RCA. There is a commercial that I have at the very end of the Apollo 7 chapter where they show the television screen. They didn't market cameras as such because that type of camera technology wouldn't have worked as a domestic system.
Right.
But they, for example, the RCA commercial on the Apollo, on the historic Apollo mission, your TV set was a window to outer space. You saw America complete one of the vital steps in its program to land men on the moon. You saw it live from outer space through the eyes of the Apollo television system designed and developed by RCA. So they would use it as a marketing pin to market their other products by saying, look, we are good enough. We developed the TV cameras for Apollo. Therefore, our TVs also have the same high standard of technology.
Fascinating. You have your first caller on the line. Caller, are you still with us, please?
Yes.
And you are?
This is John in Atlanta.
Go for it.
I just wanted to make a comment on that cover on your book there. I mean, come on. We had better, more advanced TVs than that. I remember we watched that on 23-inch Zenith TV, color TV.
Well, yeah, but this was sort of the classic TV that, you know, in the 40s and the early 50s people had in apartments,
yeah,
and things like that. And it's a cool picture.
Yeah, I just thought, I just kid you around there a little bit.
What else do you have to say? They didn't have, anything else, John?
Well, I've seen a preview for the next Transformers movie, and that they're revealing that there's a 21-minute gap for the Apollo astronauts went over a hill and looked at this alien spacecraft that crashed and involving the Transformer type robots or whatever.
Well, I'm sure that's a quality documentary.
Yes, well.
Dwight, let me rephrase his question. Was there anything that you researched or made your eyes stand up or anything that suggests that the signal could have been tampered with before we saw it on our TV sets?
No, the only just coming to the Transformers story. They modify the archival footage of the Apollo 11 telecast to make it look like there was a 21-minute dropout, and that was never the case. The only time they lost signal was when the spacecraft passed around the far side of the moon out of contact with the Earth while they were in orbit. So they could have theoretically landed, but anybody who had a calculator could work out that there was no time to go land, look at this spaceship, take the lunar module off again, and then re-land it back at the Sea of Tranquility. It is a physical impossibility given the technology they had there. For starters, they couldn't have left the bottom part of the lunar module on the surface to come back up and then not have anything to land at the proper landing site. So, to be perfectly honest, I want to go and see the movie because anything that has Apollo stuff on it, I want to see it. But I'm not holding my breath. I fell asleep in the last Transformers movie, but that's more because I just came off night shift and was dragged along to the cinema.
Are you saying the Transformers would doctor history?
It's obviously an alternative timeline.
And we can't rely on them for our history?
We can't, but the people in the other timeline, the alternative parallel universe, they can, sure, yeah.
Well, I guess if we can rely on The Daily Show for our news, we can rely on Transformers movies, too. So that probably works. John, so since you're a fan of the Transformers, are you going to go see it?
I'm not sure I'm a fan, but I saw the coming attraction while watching another film. But but I probably might. It depends. The last one was pretty hideous, as I recall. But
do they use a heavy lift launcher, those Transformers?
I don't know. another Apollo-related movie coming up very shortly, I understand, called Apollo 18 also. But I haven't seen much about what that's going to be. But
I don't know. Where does Apollo 18 go?
I guess the moon, but I just thought it was interesting that I thought that mission was canceled, but apparently
maybe
a conspiracy theory movie is going to present a different viewpoint.
I guess it was a dark project that maybe went to the face on Mars instead.
It's something I've only seen the catchphrase, and it says there's a reason we've never been back, and it's got like a alien claw on the logo or something like that. I've only seen just that. I've not seen any trailer or preview.
Yeah. Well, I just thought I'd add a little fun to this.
You ought to get the book, John. You'd find it fascinating. It
looks like a very good story. I enjoyed the show a lot.
It is exceptional, and in fact, when you turn to page 119, I mean, just some of these historical pictures, right? They're so funny to look at today. So you got Max Engert, NASA manager of the TV system, holding the TV camera mock-up. So, you know, it's got. It looks like it's something from a cheesy 1950s sci-fi movie that I've seen. And you know, they're in shiny gabardine suits with narrow ties. And I mean, you know, real short crew-cut hair. I mean, in a way, it's hilarious.
You know what? A lot of people say that camera looks like a lasagna thing.
I mean, it... Trust me on this. It looks like this guy's about to zap a people-eating alien in a 1950s cheesy sci-fi movie. You know, it doesn't look like anything that would be real. Again, if you get the book, everyone, this is page 119. John, anything else from you?
I think that's it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
That does free up the line for anyone else who would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. You also show, I mean, the pictures in the book, people, are amazing. Plus, it comes with a CD. But you've got the RCA scan converter used to convert the slow scan black and white TV images from Apollo 7, 8, 9, and 11. And you don't give the dimensions of it, but this thing, you know, looks like the size of my garage. I mean, you know, this equipment was huge.
And in those days, they thought, wow, it's amazing we can fit it into something this small.
Boy, does our perspective change, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like the Apollo-Soyuz test project camera down in Tidbinbilla, the photograph of the author in the back of the book. That thing is the heaviest piece of equipment. You look at it, you think, oh, it's light. I was trembling holding that thing up. It is so heavy. And I thought, well, in space it doesn't matter. But I can understand with weight restrictions why they were so concerned about this, because it is dead weight, really. Very, very heavy.
Very, very interesting. When you do lectures in person and things like that, what seems to be what most people want to know, what, you know, and I would imagine most people are not space informed or space cadets. So what do they seem to remember or want to know or ask about having gone to the moon? I'm also making the assumption that most people have seen video of it on YouTube, heard Neil talking and Buzz and others, or seen other movies that have come out with a lot of excerpts, you know, documentaries. There's been a lot of lunar documentaries that have come out. What seems to be what captures most people?
The fact that it happened, and there's a lot of questions I get with how did they steer the camera for the launch of the lunar module, which happened on Apollo 15, 16, and 17. And... Well, you get the conspiracy people that think it was all faked in the studio, or you'll get the other ones that want to know, genuinely want to know, how did they do that? Did they leave an astronaut behind? And I will tell them, no, it was steered remotely by Ed Fendell sitting in Master Control in Houston using a push-button system that had zoom in, zoom out, pan up, pan tilt up, tilt down, pan left, pan right, and incremental settings that would do two functions at once. And his rationale, which he was always saying, the thing he learned to do, as soon as the astronauts would stop at one of their designated stops, the first thing he would do is zoom out to get a full view of the area so that the scientists in the back room could see, okay, there is that feature there, there is this and that and the rest of it. Once they established what the surrounding looked like, he would then do a 360-degree pan to get a full image of it. Then he would zoom in on the astronauts doing their job, and it was basically a window looking over the shoulder of what these guys were doing on the moon.
I want to clarify something. You really got comments wondering if they left an astronaut on the moon?
Yep.
Kids or by adults?
There are some adults. I tend to think that is more of a failing of their education system.
Yeah, I would think so.
When kids ask it, it's for a kid, it's a legitimate question. I will answer them and point it out to them. And I mean, for the day, it was pretty high tech electronics, an 8-bit control system that was telecom. When they put that the golden umbrella that is sitting on the lunar rover, that was sending the television up to the Earth and receiving the command controls coming back down. And the inherent 1.5-second delay getting there and coming back, and then the amount of time Ed Fendell had to think, oh, what do I do now? So there was, give or take, 2 seconds, about a 5-second delay with every command he did to the time you would see it on the screen back on Earth.
Did we leave an astronaut behind? Amazing. Hold there. We're going to take our next break because we're at the top of the hour. We will not leave you behind. I promise that. And we'll be back in 3 minutes, everyone. Again, if you want to call us, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is live TV from the moon today. We're talking about this new Apogee book. The author, Dwight Stephen Bonzeski. Did I do it right?
Almost. Yeah,
oh, God. I'm blaming it on my Oklahoma heritage. That's
call him that guy.
That guy, Dwight Stephen Dash. Carolyn in Salt Lake City said, did they have to do anything special for photography to record the golf shot?
No, that camera was mounted on the tripod. That was the last mission before they had it mounted on the lunar rover. They positioned that around about, I'm sorry, I keep going into metric, and I do not know how to convert. I think
it's that's okay. You can use metric. That's okay. They know what it is. Listen to the show.
Around about 25 meters away from the lunar module, they positioned it, and Al Shepard had all the tools necessary to quickly modify his tools to become a golf club. He had the golf ball and put it down on the lunar surface and took a swing with it, and that's how it happened. And it was all pre-approved. That wasn't a surprise dropped on mission control. He cleared that with Deke Slayton beforehand.
Jack is in Virginia, And he has an email question. Again, listeners, by the way, the toll-free number for those of you who want to quit using email and actually call us, 1-866-687-7223. Okay, Jack in Virginia, do you envision a commercial market for a lunar reality television show when humans return to the moon? For example, do you see a viable commercial documentary market for Eric Anderson's $150 million per seat lunar treks and other subsequent private surface treks? What might you recommend to develop such a niche market based upon your unique research?
To be perfectly honest, I can't see anybody going near the moon for quite some time at the moment.
Ah, shush! You can't say that out loud. A policymaker
well,
might hear you. A policymaker in Congress might hear you and take that at face value.
Oh, that's unfortunately the vibe we get over here. That it seems the U.S. has lost the plot with space travel. You know, we're here in Germany. We're right next door to the Russians, and they launch Soyuz as like they're going out of fashion. I would like to think the Americans get their vision back. And hearing the comment by the president the other day that we need another Sputnik, I think he wasn't off the mark there, but might do well in allowing a bit more funding to NASA to be able to do these sort of things. I'd be all for it. I think commercialization of space is the only way to go, and I also think international cooperation is the only way to go, because a single country these days cannot afford to do it on their own.
So do you think, though, in trying to pin you down to be specific here, there is some kind of a market for a lunar reality show and
there might be, but given the way that public opinion just swayed away from any sort of interest in the Apollo missions by the time 17 came around, it might work for the first show, and that would be it. I think public opinion would just be like, nah, seen it, click, next thing. Which is exactly what happened back in the days when lunar landings were a reality. People just they were complaining to NASA that their scheduled reruns of I Love Lucy were being interrupted by a real transmission from outer space. So I can't see much hope for the future if in the days when it was brand new that people were apathetic about it, that when it becomes commonplace, very difficult to
say. But reality TV shows, you know, thrive series after series after series. So basically what you're saying is having it on the moon would be sort of a gimmick that would wear out real quickly.
Yep, that's what I think. That's what I think. I am unfortunately guilty of transmitting those reality shows to everybody.
Oh, shame on you.
It pays my bills, that's all I'm saying.
Do you hear any talk about doing a lunar or space reality show within the industry?
No, but what I do hear is about having like a webcam on the lunar surface. That I hear a lot of.
And what would that webcam do?
Basically like the weather cams you have here that would be possibly remote controlled from Earth, so somebody could... I've done it with a webcam in Sydney when I've been here wanting to watch the New Year's fireworks. You can actually... You get a designated time via the internet that allows you to control that camera. And you can steer it left or right, just like Ed Fendell did. And now it's not that big stretch to get something like that onto the moon. They just have to get the rocket to plant the thing there in the first place. They don't necessarily need an astronaut to put it there. They could do it remotely. And that would be pretty cool. And these days with high definition, like the YAXA probe the other day that did the Earth roll the other day, a couple of years ago, the Earth rise. Again, in high definition, you look at it, you go, wow, that actually looks really, really cool. So I envision more the webcam type scenarios than any... I don't know about reality type TV shows. There's no doubt that something like that will happen in the future.
At some point, yeah, I would agree with you. So Apollo ends, and we start in with Skylab that had too short of a life expectancy. Did the camera technology transfer over to Skylab, or was that a new leap forward in technology? How can you compare and contrast Apollo to Skylab?
Well, Skylab had multiple cameras inside the space station, so they were virtually a little television studio. They could switch between a camera that was in the lower quarters to one in the command module to one that was shooting the astronauts outside. They could do that all either in the station or controlled from the ground. There was a plan prior to the station being damaged when it launched to use one of the scientific airlocks as a boom arm and connect a camera to the end of the boom arm that would take shots like the Canad arm does on the space shuttle now. They were planning that back in 1973. Then with Apollo-Soyuz test project, that was also the Westinghouse cameras, which they used on Skylab. They had multiple cameras as well. They had four cameras on that mission, and they could switch between each one of them at any time. And when I watched those missions, I just think if they had have had that technology on the moon, it would have been fantastic. You would have had different views from wherever. You know, who knows what they would have done. There was one idea that was proposed to have the lunar module, the lunar rover from a previous mission drive remotely using the TV camera as the eyes to drive it to the next proposed landing site, to stand there and wait over the course of the months it took for the next mission to arrive, and sit there and video the lunar module as it came down and landed at the new site. And that would have been spectacular.
Why didn't they do that?
Logistics. There was no feasible way to do it within the budget constraints. They needed much, much more money to be able to pull off something like that. It was technically possible. They just didn't have the finances to do it.
Harry, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, can you compare and contrast the television and the video from Apollo and Skylab to, say, what is on Shuttle and the International Space Station? Are we talking about eons of technology advancement, or is the technology advancement really only minor and sort of slow go? That's what he said.
The sequential color system was used on the space shuttle right up until the mid to late 1980s, possibly even into the 90s. I'm just doing the research at the moment as to when that was decommissioned. It was round about the end of the decade. The first camcorder went up in 1989 with STS-30. And the best quote I can give you is from ground control. When they saw the pictures coming in, they said, look, the people who have been down here long enough can tell you that's the best TV pictures they've seen. So the technology did increase. It wouldn't have been the mammoth amounts that were evident, say, between the first test television from Mercury through to Apollo 17. But it has been a slow and steady increase, to the fact that now they don't even have the color sequential anymore. They just have camcorders, stock standard, off-the-shelf camcorders. What has happened in the meantime is the commercial industry has actually overtaken the pioneering research of NASA. And Max Engert, who we were talking about before, well, I was speaking to him on the telephone, and he said, look, the next big technological breakthrough with television won't come from somebody like NASA. It'll come from the private sector.
And that's being borne out then.
Yeah, definitely.
What about the ability for NASA to take the signal and bring it back to Earth and transmit it? Has that side of the technology changed dramatically?
Dramatically, in the sense it's gone from analog conversion using like the disc recorders to a digital system, which was implemented also during the shuttle era. And that is now the standard digital reception. There's no more analog as far as video goes, to the best of my knowledge. And I need to I'm just at the tail end of the research for that. So
are you going to have
I'm wrong.
Is your research going to be a follow-up book to this live TV on the moon?
I'm hoping so. I felt I owed it to Stan to tell the rest of his story. He was so passionate about Skylab and Apollo Soyuz test project. And then I felt it was a nice finish to it, considering the shuttle is being decommissioned now, to take it up to the end of the shuttle era, and then it's basically covered with all the technological advancements that happen in television. Everything that comes now will come from the private sector, as far as TV goes.
So your next book goes to the retirement of the shuttle?
Yes.
And they're just, so everything is off-the-shelf technology pretty much now?
Pretty much now, yeah. In the case of the shuttle, they had an operational system in there, so they didn't decommission it the second that the first camcorder went up, but it was slowly phased out to the point that the entire system is now wired up to use camcorders rather than the bulky sequential cam.
So they don't harden them against radiation or do any protecting from cold temperatures or anything like that?
Yes, for the ones that are mounted outside, obviously. The ones inside are just stock standard off-the-shelf cameras.
So if it's going outside, they're still modified?
Yes, it needs to have the thermal protection, definitely. But they have cameras at the back of the bays that are used to monitor what's happening inside the cargo bay, and they definitely need to be protected from the effects of vacuum and the temperature extremes.
So is there any debate at all anymore within NASA or the space program about live television from space, or is that totally a given now and it'll always be that way?
That's a total given now. That became very, very evident after the mishap on Apollo 12, where NASA realized very quickly that television was the window into their missions, and was partly responsible for funding, because that was the only way people could see what was going on. They could see where their money was being spent.
On the moon, and did they have to do anything special to record the astronaut spatial images to be able to get decent resolution on that? Did that take any special imaging or processing?
No. There was image noise reduction that was done by Image Transform, which is the same company that cleans up films like Star Wars or James Bond or Indiana Jones. They restore them to look like they're brand new. And in the early days, that is what they used there. It was a pioneering little company operating outside of Hollywood, run by John Lowry. Let me just check my facts here before I quote you the wrong thing. John Lowry, yep, who had developed a computer system that could digitally noise reduce the signal in real time and send it to Houston. And if you look at the television feeds from Apollo 16 and 17, they look as good as any studio camera. You can see a little bit of the sequential artifacting, and occasionally there is a bit of signal trouble because obviously it's traveling all the way from the moon. But those images look to me like they were recorded yesterday.
Jack has another question for you. Is it realistic to, and he's in Virginia, by the way, is it realistic to think about an IMAX camera on the moon similar to the webcam idea?
I can't see why not. Again, it's a matter of weight, but I would be pretty confident that the IMAX company would be pushing for something like that should lunar mission start again, without a doubt. You look at how many films they've done that deal with outer space, whether it be the Mir space station, the International Space Station, or the shuttle flights. They have been on a lot of the shuttle flights, and every time I see those films, I come away as if I have been out there, and I would certainly hope they do, and I'm pretty sure that they will.
This is probably off your topic, but I'll ask it anyway. And it's from Margaret, and Margaret is in Seattle, Washington. And Margaret says, on a lot of the commercial space blogs, I am now seeing information about how the European Union has created a code of conduct for outer space activities, and many different nations, including the United States, are apparently planning to sign on to it. However, this code of conduct document has language in it that may very well prevent or retard or raise the cost of doing anything with commercial space. Given that you're in Germany, have you heard of the European Union Code of Conduct for Outer Space? And can you comment on any of its language, which appears to go directly to the heart of commercial space? And in fact, if it becomes a treaty or something like that, may absolutely damage or destroy the efforts of commercial space to do things in space.
I have to be honest and say I have not heard about that. What I do know is a lot of European industry is based on private sector space. So I think those companies would have a very loud voice opposing to anything that would limit or increase limit their functionality or increase their cost.
Well,
unfortunately, I'm not well versed in the code of conduct. I can't tell you more.
I'm getting inundated with emails on this now, and I'm actually going to try to be doing some more programming on it, and also to bring in some people to teach it in my commercial space class up at North Dakota, because it does appear to be real. And you know, since when do governments always care what their industry and their people want? So I don't put anything past any government body, but I'm cynical in my old age.
Well, the European Union loves to make laws. They've got nothing better to do, so.
Yeah, that's true. Apparently we're following in the footsteps, too. They love to make laws. Private sector missions to the moon. If a private sector, well, here you have the Google Lunar X Prize, and I know that's really small scale compared to what we're talking about. But for a private company that could get to the moon, is it inconceivable to think that they could transmit something from the moon that could be live television if a network or somebody was willing to broadcast it for them?
Oh, absolutely.
It's not out of hand now or out of reach financially or anything.
That was the easiest part, sending the signal from the moon. That's not a problem at all. It was getting the things down to a usable size and within the bandwidth constraints of back in the day where you know, there was the debate, what is important to the mission? If it's a robotic mission and they send a camera up there, there would be absolutely no trouble in sending the image back.
So because the technology and the hardware is now so small and lightweight relative to what it was, you know, being able to do that and send it back by a private company would not be unthinkable at all.
No. Well, the best example I can give you, when I was researching a lot of the technical details of the signal and so forth, I asked one of our satellite engineers here, and I said, look, feasibly, is it possible for one of our television reception antennas to pick up a space shuttle S-band, and he said, there's no trouble in doing that. We just need the equipment that can decode the signal. Right, and that's just using a stock standard satellite antenna on the top of one of our buildings here.
Doesn't that decoder come with the transformer decoder ring?
Yes, it does.
John in Atlanta will love that one. So, wow. When do you think your next book will be out? Because this is such a cool book. I can't wait for your next one to come out.
Well, that rests in the hands of Apogee Books and how well this one does. Because, as you said at the beginning, it is a niche topic. And whether or not people are interested in reading about Skylab, unfortunately, it was just a passionate thing for me. I had done a lot of research for Skylab while I was doing the Apollo book, and I thought, well, there's too much of it to go into one book. I'll think about maybe at some point doing another one. And when I got the email from the JSC archives, I thought, well, now's a better time than any. Otherwise, these documents are gone, not forever, but for me in Germany to access the National Archives is way more difficult than JSC. So they they rushed all my copying requests along, so I've got all the material here, and I'm actually nearly done with the manuscript. It's just a matter of picking the right time and not putting the publisher on the spot.
You know, sometimes you need to put them on the spot. I had a lot of things marked in the book to ask you about. So one of them, and we got a few minutes left here, is on page 217. And here you're showing a set of images that sort of explain or describe the deceptive size of rocks relative to, say, an astronaut who was approaching the rock. So, were the cameras, were the TV pictures, were they somehow limited in trying to capture depth perception and things like that? Was that a little off, and that needed to have a lot of improvement as technology advanced?
No, there's nothing that technology can do with that. That's just the physical characteristics of being on the moon without any atmospheric effects. Here on the Earth, we're used to looking, say, at a mountain range that might be a couple of miles in the distance, and we see the haze of the atmosphere that lets us know, oh, those mountains are far away because they're hazy. On the moon, there's none of that. So, especially when you look at the television footage or the photographs even from Apollo 15, what looks like a hill in the background is actually a mountain that is several kilometers high and several kilometers in the background. And that is actually also what caused problems on Apollo 14 when Al Shepard and then Mitchell tried to get to Cone Crater. The depth perception prevented them from seeing that they were actually within, I think, around 30 meters from the rim of the cave of the crater. They had no idea how close they were. They just couldn't see it.
So there is no depth perception? Is that a fair way to assess it, or it's misleading?
There is, but it's difficult without some sort of an establishing feature. When they had the lunar module on the plane, say, at Hadley, They could judge the distance because they could see, okay, the lunar module that I know to be so-and-so many feet tall is that big according to my eyes now, so therefore it must be several hundred meters away. If they didn't have that, this rock here, like on House Rock, when you look at the television footage, you think at the beginning, oh, it could be maybe just the size of a washing basket, and the closer they get to it, you think, oh, it's as big as a car, and then as they get right up close to it, it's as big as a house, therefore the name House Rock. That is unfortunately something astronauts on the moon have to live with.
Do they learn to compensate for that, or because they know that's the effect, so I guess they're trained in how to compensate for that effect.
Exactly. And another thing that they had on Apollo was a limit to how far away from the lunar module they were allowed to travel, mainly for safety restraints. But you know, if they went driving too far away and they couldn't see the lunar module and they had no way to get back, that would be the end of it.
So I think a terrestrial analogy would be when I was flying seaplanes in the San Francisco Bay. They said the worst time to do this, because I was not instrument rated, was at twilight, because if the water were calm, you cannot possibly determine where the water is and the horizon ends.
Yeah,
because they merge together, and you have no depth perception and no ability to tell one from the other.
Yep, that is a precise comparison. That's exactly how it is.
So, of course, the first rule of thumb is avoid the situation. And the second rule of thumb is never, ever take your eyes off of whatever instruments you have in the plane.
Exactly. And in the case of the lunar rover, they follow their tire tracks back if they ever got lost. That was the one surefire method to get back.
What should we have talked about that I have forgotten to ask you or that we haven't had time to bring up yet, because we're getting near the end of the program? What did I forget, omit? Or what else is there that you would like to talk about with live TV from the moon?
Well, there was nothing really. We've done. There was one little interesting story that Stan LaBar was telling me with Apollo 13. That once they did the transmission shortly before the accident occurred, and while they were debating what equipment do we leave on? What do we turn off? Stan actually said to them, look, if you want to get public interest in Apollo 13, put the camera on, because people will get a window into this crisis as it's happening, and they will see what it's like in the command module. Unfortunately, fortunately, whichever way you see it, the NASA management said, no, we can't do that. That's a little bit too close to the bone. But that was one, they actually did discuss it.
What do you think the effect would be if they had to put the TV on during the accident? Do you think it would have changed anything?
They would have got a lot more news coverage, and they already had a lot of it.
The news coverage was off the chart.
Yeah. If they had a camera inside the command module, you could imagine everybody would have been tuning in to see that.
And how do you think that would have impacted the behavior of the astronauts?
From a television transmission guy's perspective, I see it as a really cool thing. From a human being's point of view, I'm glad that they didn't do it, because I think it would have caused more problems than it would have solved.
Okay. If people want to get a hold of you, have questions or comments, do you give out an email address?
I used to have one. I had to take it offline. I was getting a lot of spam email from undesirable websites, and that was at www.livetvfromthemoon.com. The website is still active. I don't have an email address there. I am a member on a board called ApolloHoax.net, where we discuss the hoax theories. And you can get in touch with me there.
They can email me, and I can forward to you as well.
Exactly. Until such time as I get the email with security coding up and running again on the website, which I'm flying to Australia day after tomorrow, so that won't be for another 3 weeks, I'm afraid.
All right. So, listeners, if you can't find him through those sources, then post your comments on the Space Show blog, and also send it to me, and I will forward it to Dwight. Well, as they say, job well done, Dwight. Outstanding book, and a story worth telling and retelling, and we thank you for writing the book and telling us this story and answering a lot of questions that many of us have had for a long, long time.
You're welcome. The one thing that amazed me with this book is I was the first person to ever come up with the idea to write about the television. That's amazing that it fell onto my shoulders.
Well, you stepped up to the plate and did a great job. So we're looking forward to your next book, and I'm sure Apogee and you will let me know when that happens, and we'll look forward to repeating this program.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And listeners, look at the newsletters. We have back to our regular schedule, because I am back in town, so we have 4 programs this week, lots of variety on what we're talking about. And we look forward to having you join us and participate with all of our Space Show programs. Special thanks to Dwight and the old teams that made TV possible when we went to the moon. And let's hope we go to the moon again someday soon. Take care, and thank you very much, Dwight, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. And listeners, thanks again. Goodbye from the Space Show.